And I usually play this piece kind of as a caveat, because when you're talking about headphones and sound and space, and obviously in this kind of public address system, I can't play that type of music for you. I think this piece, however, starts to get to the spirit of what I'm at. So I usually play it when I talk about this subject. So first of all, I just want to say thank you for inviting me here. It's great to be here. It's a beautiful location. It's amazing. this paper, I've given it a few times. It's been published a few times as well. So this is maybe a late edition, so I'd love some feedback. It's been through the ringer a few times, so by all means, dive in at the end. So I'm going to read it today because it is somewhat of a nuanced article, and so I think that's probably the easiest way for me to do it, and we'll try to get her done in 20 minutes or so. Continuing the trajectory of listening first established by the medical stethoscope, this essay discusses the role of headphones in shaping our acoustic perception of the world and the resulting spatial organization of our subjectivity. Instead of considering the social relations of sound reproduction as is the norm in humanities and cultural studies, and the high fidelity of headphone technology in scientific research and development and consumerist desire, this essay considers the psychoacoustics of headphone space from a phenomenological position. So there's a great pairing, I think, today between the two papers. Mine will be a little more historical, I think, in general. Particularly, I want to explore the strange effect of in-head acoustic imaging, which is usually deemed a noisy artifact of technology. A survey of the literature on the topic reveals that little is written on the history and the development of headphones compared to the length of their use. I say here longer than, let's say, motion pictures, for example. And their present ubiquity in several fields, ranging from the military to the arts, from medicine to the news. The first part of this essay traces the history of modern listening as developed by the stethoscope and the technical system maintained with headphones. The second part of this essay presents four sound artists who creatively work with headphones for particular spatial results. In the 21st century, Bruce Nauman may be crying for us to get out of his mind, but he and other sound artists are wanting more and more to get into our heads. What matters is not only what they are saying, but how you are listening to it. So interiority versus the in-head acoustic imaging. From the 20th century onwards, the concept of interiority has been treated with suspicion in many areas of science and philosophy. Ironically, as the current neuroscience theories argue for a bottom-up theory of consciousness, the ubiquity of headphones creates an effect reminiscent of Descartes' air, locating the seat of the soul in the pineal gland. We need not look at current theories for the debunking of the seat of the soul, however. Thinking concurrent with the development of the stethoscope and the invention of headphones already expressed this concern. One of the strongest critiques came from Merleau-Ponty, an elegant reworking of Husserl's notion of phenomenology, where the starting point lies in the subject embodied in the external world of the everyday. In this context, the term interior itself becomes pejorative. As Merleau-Ponty points out, interiority is partly born out of a historical and religious sense of being rooted in Christian mystical language, such as St. Augustine's interior omine. However, Merleau-Ponty famously disagrees with Augustine's conception. Truth does not inhabit only the inner man, or more accurately, there is no inner man. Man is in the world, and only in the world does he know himself. But interiority is not solely the product of religion, nor the derelict relic of it. Instead of conceptualizing interiority as a mystical utopia or non-place, what does it mean when we think of interiority in either a Cartesian, and I mean spatial Cartesian, not philosophical Cartesian, and even perhaps non-Euclidean space? Our first step lies in saying what it means to conceive space that is not necessarily out in the world, but in one's head. I am not referring here to what the mind eye sees in a sense of like an Oliver Sacks type of mentality, but rather the spatial possibilities of what acoustic engineers call in-head acoustic imaging. To experience such a phenomenon, a certain tool is needed, headphones. A modern technological prosthetic, headphones are quite literally a bracketing of the world for a precise analysis of sound, and allows a focused investigation into what Roland Barthes might call a phenomenology of interiority. For with headphones, a unique acoustic experience can be created like anything else in the history of listening. That is, except for its immediate precursor, the stereo stethoscope. To trace this trajectory, this historical account of techne, to borrow a Heideggerian word, the stethoscope deserves attention for its creation of technique, or listening that continues in the technology of headphones. So, from stethoscopes to headphones, or constructing interior spaces. A brief history of the stethoscope allows us to determine two important attributes to the development of modern listening, materialized in headphones. First, we can determine the difference between listening to an interior space of the body versus creating an interior space in the body. Second, we can create we can locate the technique of listening with headphones within a longer historical evolution of modern audition. Collecting the research of several philosophers, cultural artifacts, and medical historians, Jonathan Stern from McGill University constructs a historical narrative of sound reproduction that includes the history of the stethoscope as a pivotal artifact in the development of modern listening. Dating back to 1816, the invention of the stethoscope becomes a site where cultural techniques of listening are both developed and reified. Working mainly from R.T.H. Lanick's Treatise on the Disease of the Chest and on the Mediate Auscultation, written in 1819, Stern constructs a history of doctor-patient relations, medical epistemology, and listening practice. Key to Stern's research is his observation that the medical paradigm shifted from listening to the meaning of the voice as a bearer of truth to the sound of the voice as truth in itself, to borrow some language that we were using in the last presentation. In other words, instead of a doctor listening to the language which the patients used to describe their maladies, the stethoscope focused a different engagement with the patient by listening to the sound of the voice's sonic quality as it resonated in the body. And here's a quote from Jonathan Stern. The pure voice becomes a kind of sound effect, a container of timbre and an index of states that has shaped it. End of quote. Focusing, intensifying, and isolating the sound of the internal body with the stethoscope created an increased valuation of sound in medicine during this century. The interior of the body was listened to with great care because the whole thorax became a kind of resonating chamber, the lungs especially, like the interior of an instrument. While the stethoscope provides a shift in doctor-patient relations, it also creates a new sonic framework that was previously unheard, literally. And this is where my research deviates from Jonathan Stern's excellent research that he's done. He's much more of a Marxist sociological aspect of the relationship between people within the history and how sound participates in that. I'm more interested in psychoacoustics and kind of a spatial treatment in an aesthetic standpoint. Binaural stethoscope provides the first event of in-head acoustic imaging. I'm not referring to the listening of the interior of the patient's body, which is actually the old practice of auscultation dating back to Hippocrates, but rather the reconstruction of the doctor's psychological image of his own body and his resulting consciousness. With the use of the binaural stethoscope, and subsequently with headphones, a sound field can be virtually located within the head. More accurately, and this is the paradox, space is projected within the mass of the body where sound masses float in an impossible space. This image makes us think of a similar situation described only a few years previous to the invention of the stethoscope. I'm referring to Hegel's description of the night of the world, the poetic description of the birth of the subject based upon the transcendental imagination. I'll read this very great poetic and dramatic quote. The human being is this night, this empty nothing that contains everything in its simplicity, an unending wealth of many representations, images of which none belong to him or which are not present. This night, this interior nature that exists here, pure self in phantasmagorical representations, is night all around it, in which here shoots a bloody head, there another white ghastly apparition, suddenly here before it, and just so disappears. One catches sight of this night when one looks human beings in the eye into the night that becomes awful. Perhaps not so awful as awfully melodramatic. Hegel's account of the birth of subjectivity articulates an uncanny parallelism between the birth of modern philosophical phenomenology and the birth of modern medical practice. For both Hegel and Lenach, describing the modern subject entails recognizing that behind the patient's eyes is an empty space where phantasms and also phantom signals suddenly appear and disappear. The modern subject must face the creative necessity of generating his or her own intersubjectivity and the rendering and structuring of the theory. The structuring of this slippery task is fundamentally a spatial activity. So this intersubjectivity is a spatial activity, is what I'm trying to say. However, this spatial activity is not a neat box, but rather the complex topography of the urban environment and the topology of knots and Mobius loops. The twisting tubes of the stethoscope begin to map out this newfound object and subject. And I think it's a lovely switch in the medieval, the subject and the object are being thrown under, and the nice history of that switch between the subject and the object creating subjectivity. The interior space of the patient's body coincides with the interior of the doctor's body, the heart chamber remapped to the cranial cavity, organs floating in the abyss newly dissected by auditory exploration. It's here also that two senses of interior overlap. The imaginative powers of the mind's ability to imagine the space coincides with the literal location of the interior space in the head. We could read Linda Montano's Heart Murmur, a performative example of this transposition of interior space. In 1975, the American performance artist performed a piece where she listened to her own heart with a stethoscope in a gallery over 3 days. As much self-reflection as remapping, Heart Murmur, it plays perhaps on the phrase hole in the head. For Montano, the head is equipped or empty, or rather, let's say, pounded out between the ears to create a space for another interior space, the heart. One organ is remapped onto another organ, one instrument onto another. One space into another space. Lasting 3 days and not 4 minutes and 33 seconds, the always sound of John Cage's silences are rewired inside Montana as a sonic feedback loop between central nervous system and circulatory system, practicing the audition of isolation as originally fostered by the stethoscope. Montana creates her own mobile anechoic chamber. Well, the stereo stethoscope, both binaural and differential, because there are, in the history of stethoscope, there's quite a lot of different models. This allows for a transposition of a real space onto an imaginary space. The headphone allows for the creative manipulation of sound to create imaginary spaces within another imaginary space. Continuing the techniques of isolation and amplification inherent to the stethoscope, headphones provide the ability to play sound of any type, from natural to technical to musical. Become keenly aware of the space between the ears if four technical attributes are maintained. First, that an identical sound source is presented to both ears at the same volume levels, and that's called the interaural amplitude difference. The second is an absence of a temporal delay between the ears, that's an interaural time difference. The third is a lack of crosstalk or phasing that would exist with loudspeakers in a room where the reverberation or reflections from the sound source off its boundaries. And fourth, finally, the sound enters the ear directly into the ear canal when using headphones. So the listener's shoulders, the pinna, and the torso do not filter the incoming sounds, which often give equalization cues to the source of the location, is related to head-related transform functions. Combined, these four specifications allow for a sound event, which places sound mass, to use a Varese term, inside of the head. It should be noted that this type of listening was the norm, basically, until 1958, when the corporation Koss invented the first stereo headphones. So nearly 50 years later, before that, right, all the sounds that you listen to with headphones were mono, so they came in and they were split. Therefore, as a mono signal, it placed it in this weird phantasmic kind of image in the middle of your head, such as that. I love that image. it's from a beautiful book from 1922, and this high-tech farmer wasn't using special fertilizer, but he was using a radio so his wife could call him home for dinner. But anyways, these kind of headphones would be mono, so it's actually with stereo headphones, the ones we're used to today, this has completely changed. Nearly 50 years later, with binaural recordings, MS stereo recordings, and other ambisonic recordings that are mixed for headphones, we can create a convincing perception of the exterior world. Audiophiles might disagree, as might audio research engineers, but this mentality holds to the conception of high fidelity and spatial resolution embedded in the desire for mimesis. Where does this lead us to? Where does this lead us, though, I want to ask? To better tools to simulate the world. And while the spectre is important for aviation or military purposes, as well as, let's say, testing acoustical properties, I'm more interested in artists who use this to create their own worlds and use this technique because of that. So here's the last part of the essay where I'll discuss kind of four sound artists that use this particular phenomenon. Headphones are the norm. They are the new addiction replacing smoking. Headphones frame the head and the perception of most urbanites today in some form or other, from commuting with an iPod to exercising to the radio, talking on a hands-free cell phone, or actually maybe listening to music. Headphones create a mobile and continually changing architecture that follows the listener, wrapping them in a private bubble. Publicly, they are at science museum exhibits, art galleries, and the audio guide's handset for tourists. But in these cases, the sound played through these headphones are not designed for headphones. Rather, headphones are selected for the practical reasons of sound control or noise control, privacy. They're not technical or aesthetic reasons. On the other hand, while it is quite the norm for sound artists and musicians who deal with the subtlety of sound spatialization to recommend listening to their work with headphones, few of these artists specifically make work for headphone listening. Instead, headphones are a cheap compromise in the face of expensive multi-channel sound performances or sound systems. Rarely does a sound work necessitate the need for headphones to express the core intention of the work. Furthermore, there are other reasons to use headphones to play sound which have nothing to do with the unique spatial characteristics. And here the footnote leads to Christina's work, which we had a really great paper about earlier. So, a few cases do, though, require headphones to project their sound for spatial reasons, and they utilize the unique possibility for creating dynamic aural architectures. So the four I'm going to be discussing is Ryoji Ikeda, who creates psychoacoustic spaces out of a precise matrix, Bernard Leitner, who creates a phantom interior space on moving sound objects, my own work with plays with the membrane defining interior and exterior through electromagnetic forces, and Janet Cardiff and George Miller, who create mobile hybrid spaces complicating notions of interiority and exteriority. So first of all, Ryoji Ikeda describes his work as a sonic, and I quote here, a particular sonority whose quality is determined by one's listening point in relation to the loudspeakers. Furthermore, the listener can experience a particular difference between speaker playback and headphone listening. The sound signals can be thought of as a way of spotlights, end quote. Exploring the precise techniques used by audiologists and sound engineers for testing psychoacoustics, Ikeda's work explores the minutiae of sound, both in frequency and in space. While his work spans theatrical performances, expanded cinema, and sound installations with architects, he also makes a solo audio work series, some of which highlight the specific qualities of headphone listening. Almost all of Ikeda's work can be described as metric, with beats and blips piercing space-time at consistent intervals. However, the psychoacoustic effect as anything but metric or strided space that deludes and guitar scorn. Like the American minimalist before Ikeda, both bodies of work generate a topological space that is constantly in flux, even if the sequencing is much more precise than a quartz pulse. In fact, the sound's exceedingly meticulous interval forces the mind to react with a paradoxically increased intensity. The point, of course, is to modulate one type of space with another. An odd piece of Ikeda's is called C7 Continuum from the album 0 Degrees Celsius. Underlying the piece is an organic heartbeat. However, the natural sound is contrasted with the typical high-frequency oscillation pulse that his work usually has, that's normally metric and repetitive. Laying down a meditative framework, an unusual sample opens a wormhole between the history of and the future of listening. Inside Continuum, or at this point in the essay, at the same time, inversely, continuum being inside of us, we hear not only the internal heartbeat of the chest mapped into the cranium, but halfway through the song, a spatial murmur punctuates the sound field, creating a floating hole in the head that opens an ambiguous space that punctures our leaky souls. The Baroque monad may be windowless, but headphones are a neo-Baroque infrastructure allowing spotlights from hidden realms to ripple an interior space. Bernhard Leitner. Bernhard Leitner is another sound artist who released a CD in 2003 specifically to imagine the rendering of the cranial cavity. Having originally studied architecture, Leitner has been creating dynamic sound spaces, as he calls them, since the early 1970s. Often his work is permanently installed and balances metal sculpture with sound fields as an installation. Arguing that sound is a building material itself, he creates a sensory experience out of the space. He took a break in 2003 from minimal metal sculptures to create a CD specifically exploring headspace. The work is called Headscapes, and he introduces it with the following note. Headscapes are works specifically created for the interior of the head. They can only be experienced within earphones. The head is here conceived as a hollow volume, as a globe-like receptacle for time-based acoustic geometric spaces. By materially thinking, Leitner empties the head of linguistic thought and sculpts an abstract sense of space through motion. With Leitner's work, a temporal fluctuation of sound objects sketch out a sense of space through temporal modulation. I've also created a series of sound works, obviously, as this paper illustrates my intense interest with the spatiality of headphones, and this was in a series of a much larger research project on sound and architecture. Mobius Fields was one of these works created for interpreting the soundscape curated by Peter Cusack for Leonardo's Music Journal, Volume 16, actually, with Christina's work as well. A sound piece composed from field recordings both in this acoustic and electromagnetic realms, Mobius Fields is a journey through the urban landscape of Montreal, comparing audible forces with inaudible forces. It begins by constructing a narrative with a linear collage of sound events moving through the streets and eventually into the metro system. Halfway through the walk, however, the composition transitions from acoustic sounds to mono-electromagnetic sounds fluctuating inside of the skull. The walk returns to its origins, but in the second half, the same path is traced by listening to energy from the inaudible world. Positioned inside the body, the listening experience shifts perspectives from an exterior sphere to the mechanical noise production in the interior world of how things function beneath their skin, such as the coarse pulse of a wristwatch or the tonal acceleration of a metro's electric engine. With Mobius Fields, the intention is to search for a wormhole in the curved space between sound and electromagnetic. The mathematical field symbol for field is K, jargon for field, which translates in German to body from Körper. And I was particularly interested in the body moving through various fields and inversely the fields moving through the body. As Deleuze and Guattari suggest, a field is heterogeneously smooth space, welded to a very particular multiplicity, non-metric, acentered, rhizomatic multiplicities that occupy space without counting it and can be explored only by legwork. They do not meet the visual condition of being observable from a point in space external to them. An example of this is the system of sounds or even of colors as opposed to Euclidean space. And I would add here the dynamic fields of electromagnetic space. The last artist I want to talk about is Janet Cardiff and her partner George Miller and their sound work, which ranges from model cinemas to 40-channel sound installations, but most importantly, the audio walks that use binaural recordings. The success of these audio walks is dependent on how they articulate the radical difference between in-head acoustic imaging and external binaural sound fields from a psychological standpoint. Echoing the soundscape works of R. Murray Schafer, Barry Truax, and Hildegard Westerkamp from the 1970s, other Canadians, listeners to Cardiff and Miller's audio walk wear a pair of headphones with the pre-recorded soundtrack overlaid over the actual route that they are instructed to walk. Deceptively simple, Cardiff and Miller's audio walks recall William Gibson's claim, another Vancouver resident, that Walkmans are the most effective virtual reality device invented thus far. This is quite a lineage. I was also Murray Schafer's TA once, so it's a whole crew of Canadians taking over. Headphones provided a relative transparency to a supplemented reality which accounts for their effectiveness. This is versus the blinder feeling, let's say, VR goggles. By using headphones, Cardiff and Miller's work reveals a strange ambiguity of the subject's exterior, interior. The outside is recreated in a postulated sound field beyond the source of small speakers pressed to the ears. Playing on the isolation of the subject's acoustic perception of the exterior world and substituting the banality of everyday with her own manipulated cinematic version, a strange orientation occurs. The strange orientation is not due to a loss of reality, but supplemented reality. Instead, the listener enters a hybrid where a dramatic role is being given to play. In contrast to everyday life, the direct interpolation into their mind by the instructional voice of the character Janet. The spatiality of Janet's voice is also different from the rest of the binaural recordings of the soundscape. It is the difference that creates the strongest effect on the listener. First of all, the voice does not move. It is one motionless component in the entire piece. The sound effects rush by the listener's body, which in turn moves through a landscape. But Janet's voice remains firmly implanted within the cranium. Furthermore, her voice is recorded in close proximity to the microphone and in mono. On pieces such as A Large Soul River and Villa Medici Walk, her voice contrasts with her partner's voice, George, who we also hear on the recording. His voice is also recorded not binaurally, but it's through a noisy tape recorder, and the result is a mediated voice that keeps its distance from the listener, further highlighting the unmediated and direct call of Janet's voice, which is continually out of field or out of the frame. The result, Janet's voice feels like it speaks not only from within the soundscape, but from within one's own body. The outer frame is commonly associated with the act of perception itself, that which creates the frame and thus excludes it. This confusion between exterior and interior creates a sense of what most critics usually refer to as Einheimlich, a reflection that is somewhat true. However, most of the people experience Cardiff and Miller's work in an environment that is probably not familiar to them in the first place. Neither the walking route nor the generated sense of interior space in the head is probably part of the listener's everyday or childhood. However, two familiar feelings combined impress upon the listener that they should be familiar with this place. And so to conclude, but perhaps a way to engage Cardiff and Miller's work, and headphone listening in general, is not with Freud's Einheimlich, but with Lacan's topologically structured l'extimité. Developed in the later phase of Lacan's writing, the idea of l'extimité continues the importance of the voice in the psychoanalytic tradition, since Freud outlined the foundations for the talking cure. L'extimité is a neologism by Lacan who combines exterior and intimacy in a slide away from the phenomenology and structuralism into math themes, topology, and knot theory. The underlying concept starts to take shape in Seminar 7, where Lacan describes it as that something strange to me, although it is at the heart of me. Repeating the movement of Lacan's tortuous career, an investigation into a phenomenology of interiority twists a topological complication. In effect, l'extimité could be used to describe the general experience of listening with headphones. For listening to a phantom voice with headphones would be the event salon, phone being Greek for voice. Moving through a dynamic space that blurs the exterior with the interior via the topology of a Möbius loop, or better yet, a Klein bottle, the subject listens, or shall I say, the outside is on the inside of the listener. The difference between contained and container slides, as does the difference between you and I. We easily identify with our fantasies once we have become the hollow man, making room for another. The voice in my head commands me to listen. And touched by a phantom power, I do. Confessing with the words of Roland Barthes, the other collects his whole body in his voice and announces, I am collecting all of myself in my ear.